This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. District Council 37 is New York City's largest public employee union with 125,000 members and 50,000 retirees. We're part of the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, also known as AFSCME. We're on the air Sundays at 8 p.m. We rebroadcast Wednesdays at 1:30 p.m. We are also available on podcasts. Simply go to the podcast app on your smartphone and search for DC 37 State of the Union. There are now more ways to stay in touch with DC 37. You can follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Check out our website, www.dc37.net. And if you have any comments about our show, please drop us a line at stateoftheunion@dc37.net. Your feedback is always welcome. We began a conversation last week with David Margalek, former New York Times reporter and contributing editor to Vanity Fair, who has now written a book called The Promise and the Dream, The Untold Story of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. That conversation was just went by too quickly, David, and so we brought you back, and now we're going to do another 15 minutes.
Well, I'm very flattered, Chris.
It is my pleasure, sir. Before we go back to the story of King and Kennedy, I don't think I've done justice. When we met 30 years ago, you were writing a book about a very powerful white family and the dispute in their family over a will. Your book writing career has taken a very interesting turn. You have written about relationships. This is the latest of a series of books that I've seen, the Max Schmeling Joe Lewis fight, two women in Little Rock, Arkansas, who grew up in Little Rock, Arkansas, Elizabeth and Hazel, I think was the name of the book.
Yeah, about the picture of the black girl going to school and the white girl behind her screaming at her. Yeah.
You have written about civil rights and race relations through very, you know, by telling very personal stories. How did that come out to be your book writing career?
I think it's really just an instinct of mine. These are all very dramatic stories. For some reason, I'm interested in people who are oppressed. I'm interested in discrimination. I'm interested in how people react under very difficult circumstances. I'm interested in minorities. I'm interested in people who are, I'm trying to think of a polite way to put this, people who are dumped on, and the people who do the dumping. And I think that's kind of the strain that runs through all of my books, not the first one about this filthy rich family. But I always felt that that story was a little bit trivial in a way compared to the ones that I've done since then, and I've kind of graduated from that. And this is all – there's some complex psychological thing going on where I'm kind of evaluating in my own way how I would have behaved in these circumstances. What would I have done if I had lived in Little Rock in 1957? Where would I have landed? Would I have stuck my neck out for the Little Rock Nine, or would I just have kind of gone along with the flow, you know? And writing about King and Kennedy now – and this is when I was growing up. I was 16 when these two men were killed, and so it really is just a chance to explore my own psyche in a way, and my own level of tolerance and or intolerance, and to figure out who I am in these very important areas.
Now, you say in the book that King was a kind of a distant figure to you when you were.
Yeah, well, I grew up in a small New England town. You know, there were no African Americans. There was one African American girl in my class, and that was it. And so King was rather a remote figure. I mean, I wasn't even a big city kid where, you know, the races interacted a lot. So I didn't have much of an emotional connection with him.
And then you also say that his position on the Vietnam War turned you off from him at that
time.
Well,
that's right. I think that I was a patriotic 1950s guy, you know, whose own ass wasn't going to be on the line in Vietnam. And my reflexive reaction, I suppose, was to support the president, you know. And I remember thinking to myself that you know, that Martin Luther King had gone out, you know, what's the expression now, but going outside your lane,
right?
You know, and that, you know, there was a clip in one of the King documentaries the other night on television, you know, where somebody shouts at him when he's at one of the anti-Vietnam protests, somebody shouts at him, stick to civil rights, you know? Well, of course, he was, you know, he was much smarter than I was, and he realized that the two things were integrally related and that you couldn't tackle social problems at home when money was being poured down a hole in Vietnam, and that, in fact, blacks were being killed and in disproportionate numbers over there and had a vital stake in the war in Vietnam. But that was not my instinctive reaction as a 16-year-old. I'm not proud of that, but it just happens to be true.
Well, there is also, you know, within the union, AFSCME is, you know, I spent 5 days in Memphis last week because we were commemorating the 50th anniversary. King was in Memphis because of the striking sanitation workers who were members of AFSCME Local 1733.
Right. Yeah.
We try to say repeatedly that King believed that, you know, labor rights and human rights and civil rights were all connected.
Right.
And we're also kind of appalled by the, and you mentioned it in last week's show, the folks who take Martin Luther King's name as if, you know, who've sanitized him over the years, for conservative Republicans to talk about, you know, we praise Martin Luther King, but the issues that we're dealing with today have to be dealt with differently.
Everybody wants to freeze King at the Eye of a Dream speech,
right.
which was the beauty of that HBO documentary on King, you know, King in the Wilderness, because King had become a marginalized and radioactive figure. And to get back to the book for a second and the relationship between these two guys, you know, you asked me last week about how their relationship had evolved. And once Bobby Kennedy ceased to be attorney general and King and Bobby Kennedy and King were very much on the same page, one would have thought that they would have become natural allies. But they were allies really only on those commemorative plates that we talked about, where the two Kennedys and King are hanging on various parlor walls. But King had become a radicalized figure, and even by Bobby Kennedy's standards, and any national politician, anybody with national political aspirations, as Bobby Kennedy had to keep a certain distance from Martin Luther King. I mean, King was not only challenging the Vietnam War more vociferously than Bobby Kennedy was, but King was taking on the whole economic system.
Right.
And Bob, in a way that Bobby Kennedy could never have done. So the striking thing to me, I mean, we all know the speech, the memorable speech, the most famous speech that Bobby Kennedy ever gave the night that Martin Luther King was shot. And I have a whole chapter on it in my book. It's an incredibly powerful moment. But it's important to realize that that was Bobby Kennedy's really only public statement ever on Martin Luther King. Before or since. I mean, for the rest of the campaign, he didn't talk about King anymore. He gave a speech on violence the day after King was shot and never mentioned King's name the next day.
How did that... Well, we talk about the connection between the three and the historical connection. They all were assassinated. I mean, they were all killed in the 1960s. But how did that speech... You're saying that speech bonded them in ways that didn't really exist beyond that moment.
I think that's right. I think that speech gave people the impression that they were closer than they really were. And I take nothing away from Bobby Kennedy. This is an admiring portrait of him. And I came to realize that, again, I had suspicions about Bobby Kennedy, too, you know, as a kid. I thought that he was an opportunist. He'd come in on Gene McCarthy's coattails, and I resented that. But the point is really that I think that Martin Luther King had become so radicalized by that point that Bobby Kennedy could fully embrace him only once he was dead.
And yet, Martin Luther King was also getting heat within the African American community for being too mainstream and being too.
That's right. I mean, he was getting it from every direction. And which was part of the reason why he was so beleaguered and why he was so depressed and why he was so upset over what had gone on in Memphis a few days before, you know, when somebody had been the march had degenerated into violence and one man was killed. And it was why he went back to Memphis to show that he could run a nonviolent march.
Right.
And it was why he was killed. I mean, it was really because of this depression that he was feeling. He was feeling beleaguered from every direction.
And the question I have about King and the history of King, you know, there were so many writers around Bobby Kennedy.
They loved him. They loved him. Yeah.
And I always wonder, and
people like Jack Newfield, you know, people like Jack Newfield, Jimmy Breslin, they were all like unofficial members of the campaign. You know, they would give him lines for his speeches, and then they'd go out and write stories in the Village Voice or the Daily News. Yeah. I mean, it was just extraordinary. I mean, it's really inappropriate for journalists. These guys were great writers, and I'm not taking anything away from them, but they crossed the line. And yet at the same time, it's also it says something about Bobby Kennedy that reporters got so emotionally drawn into him. They, you know, people who normally would have maintained a certain distance or kept a wall between them and whoever they were covering, fell for Bobby Kennedy. He had an incredibly charismatic aura about him. And these people, there's the famous reporter Richard Harwood from the Washington Post, a tough Marine who was very wary of Bobby Kennedy. And by the end of the California primary, he'd resolved to take himself off the Bobby Kennedy beat because he felt he couldn't be objective about him. But he'd fallen for him.
Here's my question. Did Martin Luther King have the same... cadre is the wrong word, but, you know, if history gets written by... if there are writers writing about Bobby Kennedy and there are no similar writers writing about Martin Luther King, doesn't Martin Luther King become less three-dimensional and less...
Well, I think that, first of all, Martin Luther King had no similar cadre of writers around him. And Martin Luther King was a black man in the 1960s. And the Martin Luther King phenomenon was basically a black phenomenon. There were not many whites in his entourage, which is why Stanley Levison, his advisor about whom we spoke last week, is so unusual. You know, it was extremely unusual to have a white man, you know, as part of your inner circle at that point. So there was a very different relationship between, I think that there weren't white journalists really in Martin Luther King's entourage in the way that there were journalists in Bobby Kennedy's.
But so in your research in doing this book, it was perhaps easier to get into the texture of Bobby Kennedy?
I think that's exactly right. I think that one of the problems with this book in a way is that because Bobby Kennedy material was more accessible, it's more Bobby Kennedy-ocentric than maybe it should be. And it's because the material is out there, and it's a problem that historians have. I mean, I tried to get around that problem by looking at different kinds of sources and sort of writing the balance in my own way. But there's, you know, the Kennedys have a whole industry of memorializing themselves. I mean, the Kennedy Library, the Kennedys were taking oral histories within weeks or months of the assassinations of these guys. They were preserving memories of these guys. There are thousands, hundreds of thousands of pages of oral history. The Kennedy material is much more accessible than the King material. And history, and for a book like this, reflects that disparity.
This could be an impossibly unfair question. What do you think the world would be like if Kennedy and King had survived?
I think it would be a lot better. That's the bottom line. I mean, there's no telling how these two guys would have interacted, how they would have felt about one another. It could be that in some ways they're more powerful as symbols maybe than had they lived. I don't know. I mean, I think that Martin Luther King was sort of acting as if his life was over and expected his life to be over. It's kind of, you know...
At the age of 39.
You know, at the age of 39, there's that there's that funny line about friend that attributed to Gore Vidal. He said it of a lot of different people originally about Truman Capote, that for Truman Capote, dying was a good career move.
Oh, God.
All right. I mean, I wouldn't, you know, listen, it would be obscene to say that about these guys. But Martin Luther King is a very important symbol. I mean, one has to wonder whether there'd be a holiday named after him if he'd had a different fate.
The book is called The Promise and the Dream, The Untold Story of Martin Luther King and Robert Kennedy. We've been talking with David Margolick. the author of the book. It's available on Amazon.
Amazon.
And
at your local bookstores, I hope.
Thank you very much, sir.
It's my pleasure, Chris. Thank you for having me.
We'll be right back.
Were you a September 11th responder or volunteer? Were you present at the dust cloud on 9/11? Do you live, work, or go to school in the New York City disaster area on 9/11 or in the following months? Do you now suffer from problems such as chronic cough, shortness of breath, anxiety, depression, or have other symptoms? If so, you may be eligible for the World Trade Center Health Program and could receive medical monitoring and treatment at no out-of-pocket cost to you. To learn more about the program and get an application, go to www.cdc.gov/WTC or call 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care. Call today. 1-888-982-4748. 1-888-982-4748. If you were there, you deserve care.
Back. This is State of the Union, the District Council 37 radio show on 91.5 WNYE FM. I'm Chris Policano. We're with Vincent Varialli, who is the president of Local 3621, which is the Uniformed EMS Officers Local. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Good morning.
We're talking about the establishment of a career ladder for EMS members, for your members, and this is something that you've been working on for a very long time. Why don't you just tell us briefly what the issue is, what you're trying to accomplish, and what has been accomplished.
Sure. So thank you for having me on the show. We, for the past, 30 years, EMS has been trying to obtain a career ladder, a civil service career ladder. For all these years, we've had lieutenant as a civil service exam. But titles such as captain, deputy chief, and division chief have always been at the behest of whomever wants to pick you, meaning the higher management, upper management. And usually it's been that upper management would pick and choose people that they were familiar with or friendly with. We always say, if you're in the cigar club, you get picked and get promoted. We wanted to put an end to that. We felt that while some people who were qualified were picked, a lot weren't qualified, were picked. We think that the best way to, the best process anyway, is civil service exams. It's transparent. It's very simple. You pass a test, you have the knowledge, you get to be promoted to the next level. It provides a level playing field and opportunities for everyone in the service to be promoted to the next level. There was also an issue of diversity in the higher ranks that we saw for many years, that the further away we went from civil service exam of lieutenant, the lines were bleached, I should say.
Bleacher.
Well, my wife scratched it out. So we noticed diversity was less and less as you went into the upper ranks. So this would, we believe, would solve the problem. Like I said, it would provide an equal opportunity for all members to take an exam and be promoted.
Is this what happens in other departments, in other units? Is this unique to EMS, or is this also? I mean, how are in the fire department, in the police department, how are these selections made?
That's a good question. EMS was the only emergency service that did not have civil service exams on all those levels. Police has civil service for sergeant, lieutenant, captain. Fire has it for lieutenant, captain, battalion chief, deputy chief, fire marshal. Sanitation has at three promotion levels. EMS is the only one that had one. And EMS being 35% women and 50% minority, you know, I look around the room and see the other uniformed emergency services, and I start to wonder why don't we have these opportunities that these other uniformed emergency services have?
So now what have you – okay, so this is a fight – this is a fight that you've been fighting for years now, and it seems on the merits of the case to make a lot of sense. What have you had to do to push this agenda forward?
Well, we've had conversations numerous times with City Hall. Unfortunately, they have not been sympathetic to our fight for equalization and fairness and obtaining these civil service exams. So we started, I became president in 2009 and began to have conversations with members of our state assembly, the state senate, with the governor, and the city council, and we've tried to build these relationships and explain to them the problems we have in EMS, how we need to build a level playing field of transparency for career ladder for people. And throughout the years, the last 9 years I've been president, we have gotten to the point where now the assembly has passed the bill. The Senate, I'm happy to say, has passed the bill. And now we are waiting for Governor Cuomo to sign it into law and provide these civil service exams for all our members.
And so the challenges of getting to that point, I mean, you're talking about a 9-year effort that has, these things take time, right? These and so the assembly's on board, the Senate's on board, it's awaiting Governor Cuomo's approval, and then from there, assuming that you get Governor Cuomo's approval, what happens next?
Well, according to civil service law, a provisional can only maintain this title for 9 months, and a civil service exam has to be presented, and civil service members then have to be put in place of that position. Obviously, these are three new ranks, and we understand it takes time to do all this, so we'll see what happens then. What I found to be very discouraging is that the mayor was opposed to these civil service exams, and I've heard him say many times, make speeches about fairness and equality and the tale of two cities at one point. EMS has lived the tales of two departments for a long time. And we're looking for fairness and equality because we have the diversity that he always speaks about. We have 35% women. We have 50% minority. So we are the people that he claims he wants to help. I don't know why he would oppose this, but you know, one thing at a time. We look forward to the governor signing this bill, and then we'll take it on with DCAS and the city, and hopefully they will respect the law and allow this to go forward.
And this was a challenge for the previous mayor as well, that you had the same kind of reaction to this?
This has been a challenge for previous mayors, previous presidents of our local and EMS local 2507, the EMTs and paramedics and fire inspectors local. They also have been supporting us. So this has been a challenge, like I said, for about 30 years, and we've made some progress in the last 8 years, 9 years I've been a president.
We're talking with Vinny Variali. He's the president of Local 3621, the Uniformed EMS Officers Local. I know that there's been an issue. I'm going to switch gears for a bit. I know that there's been an issue in recent years. We've talked about this before. You've been on the show before about the privatization of ambulance services. And I was wondering if you could update us on what's going on now and what the issues are around privatization.
Sure. Recently, Community Hospital is the next private ambulance company pulled out of the 911 system. And the mayor just put $4 million into the budget to hire additional EMTs and paramedics to service that area, the communities in that area. We're pleased to see that, obviously. I think it does a lot because our FDNY EMTs and paramedics are the best there are. They're better trained. They've received more training, and they'll do a terrific job in response time and providing medical care to the people of those communities. What I'd like to see happen, though, is to also increase the amount of lieutenants, EMS lieutenants and captains for these neighborhoods, because EMS has a severe lack of span of control when compared to other emergency services such as police and fire. Span of control is the ratio between one supervisor to amount of individuals, in this case, emergency responders, EMTs, and paramedics. The ratio should be 1 in 7. Fire follows a 1 in 4, 1 in 5. Police follows a 1 in 8. EMS, the current ratio is 1 in 20. Sometimes it's 1 in 40 or 1 in 60. That's unacceptable, and that endangers people's lives. The fire department's own statistics have shown whenever an EMS lieutenant is on the scene of a cardiac arrest, the survival rate for that patient increases. And we believe the reason for that is because the lieutenant is needed to help coordinate with operations on the scene, allowing the EMTs and paramedics to focus solely on the patient while the lieutenant handles communications and other things or aspects that go on with the job. So that's something that needs to be looked at. Also, we need more facilities. Our facilities are bursting at the seams. We have EMTs, men and women, changing in front of each other in the garage itself, next to the ambulance in the garage that we work in. It's unacceptable. You know, we need more stations. We're bursting at the seams. We have to provide these facilities for members that, you know, just hiring them, you can't pack them in like sardines.
So in the budget for I guess, for fiscal year 2019, which is being negotiated now, you're looking for capital improvements on EMS structures or EMS property facilities?
Yes, we need more EMS facilities. I'd like to remind the city also, when we merged into the fire department back then in 1996, they told us we were going to have 70 stations. Well, today we only have 37, so we're a little bit short. But we need a lot more facilities to better be able to serve the communities. We also need a better span of control than we currently have today to better serve the communities, to save lives. I mean, this is a very serious job. This is a job of life and death. And when we're shorthanded and we don't have the resources or the facilities, people will die.
That was a conversation we had with the president of Local 3621, Vincent Varialli, in the early part of April. Before we go, I first want to take a point of personal privilege. Paul Booth was an official with the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees for many years in Washington, D.C. He recently passed away. Paul knew everybody. He knew his stuff, and he knew how to have a good time. He loved his family, he loved the Cubs, and he loved trying to make the world a better place. Except for the part about the Cubs, I can't think of finer qualities. Just wanted to say here on behalf of the DC 37 family that you are missed, my friend. That's just about all the time we have for this show. Before we go, we have a couple of announcements. To find out the latest about issues impacting our union and your workplace, please attend organizing department meetings at your job site. For dates and locations, call 212-815-1095. In the month of May, there will be a number of town hall meetings throughout the city with DC 37 Executive Director Henry Garrido. To find out more about those meetings, please call 212-815-1095. The Education Fund is offering an advanced public speaking course. To find out more about the course, please call 212-815-1700. And the Municipal Employee Legal Services reminds you that they provide legal representation to members when applying for citizenship. For more information, call 212-815-1818. I want to thank our guests, David Margolick, the author of The Promise and the Dream, which is available by checking out Amazon, and Local 3621 President Vincent Varialli for joining us this evening. Any comments about this show, please send it to stateoftheunion@dc37.net. We always appreciate the feedback. Check out our website, www.dc37.net. The producer is Rudy Orozco. The sound engineer is Andrea Minocchio. I am Chris Policano. Until next time, ciao.